Sports in the Teens.
WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans are polluting themselves with fatty foods to epidemic proportions. So claims Greg Kitzer in his new book, Fatlands, How Americans Became the Fattest People in the World. There are 50 million obese Americans. We used to blame gluttony, but Kreitzer says that profit-seeking big food, politically expedient trade deals, and a national case of denial have put us on the fast track to fat. Next, On Point, America the Supersized. We begin with news on the fast food giant McDonald's, which today reported its first quarterly loss since the company went public in 1965. Yesterday, a federal judge dismissed the case on behalf of four overweight New York City teenagers who blamed McDonald's for their obesity and related health problems. Nick Buckley covers the food industry for the Financial Times. I asked him how the judge addressed the plaintiff's responsibility.
He said that the plaintiff's hadn't proved that there was a danger in eating McDonald's products that consumers didn't know, that wasn't in the common knowledge of consumers. But he actually did indicate that he might be prepared to listen to certain arguments if the plaintiffs were prepared to refile the case. And I think it is possible that they may have another go and refile an amended version of the case.
In the back and forth of the hearing, did information come out about the content of McDonald's products?
Nothing that we didn't already know, but I think what the lawyers for the plaintiffs are working on is to try and prove that McDonald's products are actually worse for you than people think or people realize. In other words, that there is a danger there that goes beyond what should be the common knowledge of consumers. I spoke to lawyers connected with the case yesterday, and they will attempt to argue, I think, that the highly processed foods of the type that you get in McDonald's are actually posing a threat which is more than people realize. A chicken McNugget has a great deal more fat, saturated fat and calories, for example, than you would expect normally from a chicken product or a fried chicken product. And they will say, therefore, McDonald's had a duty to warn its customers that these products presented a greater danger than you might realize.
So on the one hand, McDonald's got some good news from the lawsuit, but on the other hand, on the financial front, some bad news.
Yeah, the figures today were very disappointing for them. It was the first quarterly loss since McDonald's went public on the stock market in 1965. So the commercial performance of the company at the moment really leaves a lot to be desired.
Any reason people giving for the bad performance?
I think there are a lot of factors. I mean, it's important to note that the loss in the final quarter of last year was due to some special costs. They're closing a number of underperforming stores. They're actually told us that today they're going to close 700 stores, a lot more than people had previously expected. And they took a big charge to do that. If you take away the charge, then they still didn't make a reasonably healthy profit in the fourth quarter. But they're being squeezed by a number of factors. The eating out market, particularly in the U.S., which has been growing for years and years, has really stopped growing over the last 6 to 9 months. It's become a very stagnant market because of the state of the economy. So there is an external factor there, but also internal factors as well. McDonald's over the last few years, I think, has let quality of products, of standards of service, of cleanliness of its restaurants, the kind of things that people really used to count on McDonald's for, it's let those slip, and so it's facing a double problem of internal and external factors.
Competition?
Competition, of course, is increasing all the time, and there are more players going after a market that isn't growing at the moment. You've got KFC, you've got the pizza chains, all putting more and more outlets and more capacity into the market, and the market, in terms of consumption, isn't growing.
Now, they had this bad report. What about the reaction of investors? One can put together a sort of scenario in which yesterday's successful lawsuit to investors might augur more lawsuits and something on the analogy of the cigarette lawsuits, and therefore it would cool their ardor for McDonald's. Any thought about that?
I think the legal case yesterday was a setback for the attempts to sue food companies over obesity, but I don't think it will end them. I do think it is going to be a continuing problem. But having said that, I think it's going to be more a problem of inconvenience, of nuisance, of the time that they mm-hmm. spend mm-hmm. having to deal with these cases mm-hmm. and the kind of bad publicity that is generated, rather than facing huge financial penalties, certainly in the next few years. I would be very surprised if they were to lose any big cases in the coming years and suffer real financial loss as a result of that. And what should be remembered, actually, about the tobacco analogy is that although the tobacco companies have had some headline-grabbing awards against them in cases brought by individual smokers, in only one case so far has a tobacco company ever paid out for one of those cases. Mm. Most of them have got thrown out or bogged down in the appeals process. So I think the legal issue is a bit, for investors, is a bit of a side issue. I think what investors are focusing on is the performance of the company and the fact that it has a new chief executive, Jim Cantalupo, who came in to replace Jack Greenberg at the turn of the year. They want to see that he can turn around the performance and, crucially, get sales growing again in McDonald's existing stores.
Any thought that perhaps the falling has to do with the bad publicity? That is, people who weren't aware of it now know, for example, that a Big Mac has 590 calories, 34 grams of fat. You can't pick up a paper now without reading about obesity epidemic, quote unquote, and the role of fast food in it. Is there a feeling that perhaps this is a market that consumers are pulling back from on grounds of health?
I think there is a change in consumer taste. I don't think we should exaggerate it. I don't think consumers are turning away from fast food and McDonald's products in droves. I mean, in McDonald's existing stores, in the U.S., you've only seen a 1% fall in sales over the past year, just over 1%. So it's not huge numbers of consumers deserting McDonald's. But I do think there is an increasing awareness of the obesity problem. There is an increasing desire on the part of consumers to eat more healthily. Mm-hmm. And I think McDonald's has to adapt to that and has to recognize that and provide products that are more healthy. Otherwise, it does risk losing customers.
It tried that some years ago, of course, with a sort of vegetarian sandwich of some kind, didn't it?
Absolutely. The McLean, it was called.
Yeah.
It very proudly brought out the McLean. McDonald's customers hated it, didn't buy it, and it withdrew it again. And McDonald's tends to wheel out that argument whenever people talk about healthy eating and say, well, look, we tried it. And actually our customers didn't like it. But I think there are various ways of approaching this problem or this phenomenon. McDonald's is talking about making itself as a company more relevant to all sorts of eating occasions.
Mm-hmm.
One thing it is doing is investing in other smaller but growing restaurant format, the Pret-a-Manger sandwich chain, the Chipotle Mexican Grill, which are slightly more upmarket, selling healthier foods in a slightly more upmarket environment. And I think a lot of analysts and investors would like to see McDonald's putting more of their investment in future into those kind of formats rather than just building more and more and more McDonald's.
Neil Buckley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Buckley covers the food industry for the Financial Times. He spoke with us from New York. We're talking tonight about how America became the home of the fat. Just since 1970, the number of American children who are overweight has doubled. That rate of increase suggests that more than biology is involved. The American food supply has grown, and that overproduction has become overconsumption for Americans. Thanks to supersized portions and ubiquitous availability, obesity-related diseases affect a disproportionate number of those living in poor communities, especially Latinos and African Americans. But we're all paying the price in health premium insurance and in other ways. Why do you think we're so overweight? Are you tired of being told that you need to lose weight? And what is the role of the government in keeping people from becoming obese? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Pasadena, California, is Greg Kreitzer, author of Fatland, How Americans Became the Fattest People in the World. Greg Kreitzer, welcome.
Thank you.
Greg Kreitzer, how did Americans become the fattest people in the world?
The short answer is that our environment changed quite dramatically in a period of only about 25 years. if you look at what epidemiologists were saying about obesity in the post-war period and through the 60s and early 70s, they thought that the rate of overweight and obese people in the United States would top out at around 25% of the population. And indeed, for several decades, that was the case. Mm-hmm. But beginning in the late 80s, actually mid-80s and late 80s, and then continuing well into the 90s, they saw that rate double. And then by the late 90s, they saw it go to around 60.1%, and some of the new figures are around between 63 and 64%. So what attracted me about the subject in terms of writing a book about it was to narrate sort of the story of what happened to America that enabled it to become so fat.
And in your story, who are some of the unfamiliar characters?
Unfamiliar. Well, it just depends on how old you are. you know, it's recent history. So the story begins with the story of Earl Butts, who was the Secretary of Agriculture for Nixon and Gerald Ford in the 1970s. And it was Earl Butts who was really a remarkable man, a politically astute, accomplished intellectual, and a character who Nixon recruited to fix the farm vote, as he put it. Farmers were quite restive. The prices were down. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, consumers were restive. In the early 70s, we saw a rare period of a really severe price inflation for food. Mm-hmm. So they had these two parties, you know, with really conflicting goals. Mm-hmm. And what Butts did was really kind of ingenious. He said, okay, I'm going to go and open up foreign markets for our grain producers, and I'm going to encourage our grain producers, corn producers, to plant fence row to fence row. No, those were his words. Mm-hmm. And so expansion, grain production expanded, foreign markets expanded, and the farm vote got, you know, came on board for the Republican Party. But the other thing that happened was for consumers, Butts opened our borders to foreign fats and sugars, which helped drive down the cost even more of commodity prices. So that by late 70s, early 80s, you start seeing very substantial declines in the price of corn and everything that's made out of corn, from meat to sweeteners to oils to fats. So that's where the calories came from, and that's that really very much a reflective of American agricultural policy.
And then the fast food people come in.
Yeah, then the next players. What was affecting fast food sellers in the late 70s, early 80s was that their tabs, their individual or per person tabs, were staying stable. You know, mm-hmm. people were going into fast food restaurants, and because of the economic malaise, were cherry picking, you know, just getting the best deals but not buying the fries and the soda, which is mm-hmm. where the money could be made. Mm-hmm. So a number of fast food chains started experimenting, and one of the interesting ones was Taco Bell, who was under the leadership of a Harley-Davidson riding, paisley shirt-wearing man named John Martin. And Martin came in, and he said, you know what, our studies are showing that, you know, we've always emphasized sort of freshness and service and the kitchen culture of Taco Bell. But what our studies are showing is that people really want quantity, mm-hmm. you know, and they want frequency. Mm-hmm. So what they did is they ran some tests, and the first value meals, which have become, you know, ubiquitous now, mm-hmm. but were sort of difficult to get through a corporate system that viewed them as discounting or cheapening the brand name. Mm-hmm. And Martin tried this in a couple of test markets, one in Texas, I believe, and the sales went through the roof. And so
you come in and you get the whole dinner, not just the taco. You get everything.
That's right. See, if you're making your money basically not off the taco, but everything you sell around it, mm-hmm. which in the case of fast food often is the soda. And because high fructose corn syrup became very inexpensive, mm-hmm. Because of overproduction of corn, they could offer a lot more of it for just a little more money.
And so that's how the government policy of getting the cheap commodity goes into the consumption. Greg Kreitzer, we're going to come right back to you. We're asking this hour, how did America get so fat so fast? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how did America get so fat so fast? We're asking that question. Our guest is Greg Kreitzer. He's the author of Fatland, How Americans Became the Fattest People in the World. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Greg Kreitzer, you were giving us some unusual suspects and how typical of the god of irony to have one of the leading players be Earl Butts. And you gave us the supersize. What else?
Well, I think the other, if you want to kind of line up all of the actors on the stage, I think the next big one is the parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that the positive impact of the women's movement and a variety of efforts to get more women into the workplace resulted also in another phenomenon, which is what I like to call the empty table.
Mm.
Nobody literally being at home. And so fast food, which became cheaper, and convenience foods, which became cheaper. You remember TV dinners in the 60s, they were kind of a treat because they were so expensive. But in the 70s, rather than the 80s, they become less expensive. Earl Butts used to call TV dinners built-in maid service.
Mm-hmm.
And those two phenomena kind of came together. And so what you saw was an enormous rise in eating out and eating takeout foods and really the decline of the family table. And so in the book, what I go into is, okay, what happened? What was lost when you give up that communal table, something
mm-hmm.
that was an institution,
mm-hmm.
a way of educating
mm-hmm.
kids about food?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I come away with is that you send kids into a society without a kind of morality or values about food. And as a result, they're highly influenceable by the one force in American life that has no problem making absolute statements, and that, of course, is fast food advertising.
Now, this gets you in, and you're very complicated account, but just to simplify, this gets you into your remedies. And one of the things you advocate is sort of to re-stigmatize or even stigmatize fat even more.
Yeah, this is where everybody likes to jump on me. I am talking about behavior.
Yeah.
And what I try to deal with is, I think there's a lot of ways to go about, limiting the activity of fast food companies and changing government policy. But there's also got to be, if we're in a world of global turbo capitalism where we're constantly assaulted with new products and new opportunities to consume, I think part of what we have to do as individuals is to reinstitute some general boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Liberals don't have any problem educating kids, for example, that it's immoral to cut down too many redwood trees or
mm-hmm.
that it's immoral to kill too many baby seals.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you start talking to them about teaching their kids that eating too much food is bad
mm-hmm.
and bad for them,
mm-hmm.
then you start getting a lot of, I think, shrillness, particularly coming out of the academy, accusing you of stigmatizing the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that it's just one thing in our armamentarium against overconsumption.
But isn't this a kind of I said in my lead class warfare? I mean. You just have to be in Midtown Manhattan or downtown San Francisco to see that the people there look different from the people in, say, Columbus, Ohio. And one of the ways they look different is that they are markedly thin.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're sort of saying, well, the thin have to turn to the less thin and say, listen, you shouldn't do that. And, of course, the less thin in America tend to be, not as a rule, but tend to be people of lower economic circumstance, struggling.
Yeah.
Struggling often in low-wage jobs.
Actually, what I do is in the recommendation section, there's really two things going on because there's really two big groups to deal with this. One is the middle and upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that case, the gluttony thing holds true. I think that there needs to be a re-education of kids around the dinner table about
mm-hmm.
Why it's bad to eat too much food.
Mm-hmm.
I think when it comes to the poor and the working poor in the inner cities, I think that is where there needs to be a stronger and more targeted investment in a couple of things that are really big wins for everybody. One is targeted in the infrastructure, that is to say, better PE opportunities.
PE being physical education.
Yeah. better parks and recreation, so for safer streets. Mm-hmm. And I think the second thing is very important, and that is some very strategic investments in maternal health and in child health, which we know pay off in the long run in a number of different ways, one of which is that you tend not to get as much obesity when you get children who are of average birth weight rather than low birth weight. So the prescription is, you know, if you want to call it that, I think you arrive at it through a series of observations that I make in the book. But the prescription is a little bit different for those who with as opposed to those without. And I try to say that in the latter part of the book.
Okay, let's take a call from Jackie. She's in Delafield, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hi. Yes, great topic. Couple of comments. Wisconsin is probably one of the fattest states in the nation. And curiously, a couple of points that you, while you all were talking, especially just recently talking about more PE for kids, I mean, I make the observation now that there are more sports teams and more PE available to students. Mm. I'm a teacher and have been for 15 years in the area. Actually, I've taught all over the country. And yet we have more obesity. I really tie it to a couple of things. I was a girl in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the last time when kids could really kind of just run and climb trees and hang out, and there wasn't the worry about safety. And because of that, I had a lot of mobility. I roller skated, I rode bikes, I was always active. I never sat still, and I was a skinny kid like most kids of my generation. We didn't have cable TV. We didn't have computers and video games. And I think because of that, we didn't have as much of a reason to sit in the house. So we had two things. It has nothing to do with fast food. If you think about it, my grandmother, who was 100% German, cooked everything in butter and cream. And yet we were all thin. Why? Because we had physical activity. So I don't frequent fast food restaurants, and I don't have a weight problem either, and I exercise regularly, but I don't want to demonize them. I think it's tied in much more to the fact that we are so sedentary. We get in our cars to go everywhere, and we have the habit of not being physically active, and we tie that in looking at our children with the fact that we worry about their safety. Mm. And because of that, we keep them home.
Yes.
And we drive them to the soccer game
once
a week or the soccer practice.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only a couple times a week. It's not like the 3, 4, 5 hours a day that I had as a kid.
Jack,
do you think about that?
Well, let's hear what Greg Kreitzer thinks.
Well, it sounds like you read a chapter of my book. I mean, there's really the input part of weight gain and the output part of weight gain. And the other thing that we do know is that, sedentary behavior is on the increase and has been on the increase for a couple of decades. We also know that physical education programs within the schools have been gutted. If Wisconsin has a great PE program, that's great, and actually they should probably advertise it because a lot of school districts in the country are trying to figure out how to do that. There's actually only one state in the union now that requires that has a PE requirement for daily physical activity, daily physical education. But the overall rate of sedentary behavior is way up, and particularly among parents. The number one predictor of childhood obesity is the behavior of the parent. So if you have the parents watching TV and eating, a pizza every night, they're more than likely you're going to have a fat kid.
Mm. Jackie, thank you for your call. Elaine is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi.
Hello.
I love this show, and I'm really glad that you're looking at this problem.
Thank you.
I think it has so many dimensions, and I think they're all interrelated, and they reflect our culture as a whole and how we live our lives. And I think our culture as a whole is just so obsessed with consumption and excess that it seems all very tied together for me, that we overeat, we're very materialistic, we drive SUVs, we use most of the world's resources, and that we gratify ourselves so much through consumption. And it feels like we're in a really transitional time now where we're starting to gain awareness and look at our values and our culture and the effect that they're having on us and our physical health as well as a lot of other areas.
So you're saying that the consumption ethic of America, which is the sort of flywheel of our economy, that one of the negative results of that is this sort of binging in every area.
Right.
And food, too.
Right.
Mr. Kreitzer?
Sure. I mean, that's an elegant observation. I don't know how well it would fly in the Midwest. I don't tend to hear that much when I talk about this issue in the Midwest. But, you know, what we know is much of American culture is driven by two things, really, production mm-hmm. and consumption. Mm-hmm. And we are most comfortable as people either producing something or consuming something. And in between is a very stressful state for most people. One of the things I do is I talk to a lot of people who work in offices about when they eat and when they know they overeat mm-hmm. for stressful reasons. Mm-hmm. And it's not when they're really busy. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. when there is a lag where there's nothing to do. Mm. And they start eating candy bars. And they start eating cookies and everything else they can kind of get their hands on. You know, so a European, this is something that a lot of Europeans have commented on, that, you know, a lot of the kind of obsessive eating and stress eating is really because we don't have a long tradition of doing something other than producing or consuming.
Hmm. Elaine, thank you for your call. Next, we're going to hear from Paul Campos. He's joining us from Boulder, Colorado. He's a professor of law at the University of Colorado and author of the forthcoming book, The Last American Diet. He's also the author of a cover story in the recent New Republic called Rubens Was Right. Those extra pounds aren't bad for you after all, and the cover depicts a voluptuous Rubens painting. It is a voluptuous Rubens painting. Welcome, Paul Campos.
Hi, good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. You write, being fat isn't bad for you. Why?
Because fat in and of itself is not, for the most part, a health hazard, or has not been shown to be a health hazard. Excuse me, are you there?
Yes, yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. It is not a health hazard?
Well, no. I mean, the medical literature on this is, of course, very complex and very complicated. But but the evidence for the proposition that fat in and of itself actually increases people's health risks is actually quite poor. What increases people's health risks are a sedentary lifestyle and poor dietary practices in terms of eating a poorly balanced diet, too high in fats and sugars. And, of course, these things are associated with becoming fat as well. Mm-hmm. But if you look at people who have good lifestyle in terms of activity levels and dietary practices, they, in fact, have just as good health whether they're fat or they're thin. And if you look at people who have bad lifestyle practices in terms of being sedentary and in terms of bad dietary practices and especially in terms of dieting, mm-hmm. if people who diet a lot and who engage in weight cycling, as almost all dieters do, those people have poor health. So the thesis of both the New Republic article and my forthcoming book is that what actually causes, for the most part, health problems associated with weight in the United States is not weight per se, but the demonization of fat and the weight loss industry, which tells Americans that they should be conforming their bodies to an unrealistic and indeed medically unsupported supposed ideal.
Yeah, you tell some interesting things about that ideal, the BMI measurement, the body mass index measurement, and you say that according to that, George Clooney is overweight and Sammy Sosa is obese.
That's correct.
And Sammy Sosa is one of the great hitters in baseball. He's not obese. He's a big man.
That's right. He's a muscular fellow. And for instance, others, Michael Jordan is overweight, Brad Pitt is overweight. Any reasonably athletic man in this country, unless he happens to be an extreme ectomorph, is overweight, according to the federal government.
Hmm.
And I think that's just one indication of the absurdity of the body mass index tables and of the government recommendations that are based on them.
Why would the government want to, as it were, magnify what seems to be already a serious problem?
Well, because I think the ideological and political forces behind the demonization of fat are very powerful and very complicated, and essentially government health policy has been driven, I think, by – it's a sort of a cart before the horse phenomenon in that the government health policy has been driven by the desires of the diet and weight loss industry to maximize their profits. Mm-hmm. And the way that they maximize their profits is by making Americans as neurotic as possible about weight. And I think there are aspects of Greg Kreitzer's argument that are quite interesting and quite useful. I have to say that a central part of his thesis, that the problem with Americans is that we don't sufficiently stigmatize fat, is quite frankly a bizarre idea. I just don't see how anyone looking around America today, looking at the media, looking at the portrayal of thinness versus fatness, looking at the tremendous association that is explicitly made, and that in fact Greg Kreitzer himself notes, is made between thinness and success and desirability, mm-hmm. and fatness and poverty and lower class status.
How could it be stigmatized anymore?
Hmm?
How could it be stigmatized anymore?
Exactly.
Yeah. How about that, Greg Kreitzer?
Hi to Paul. I think we were on a show a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Basically, I don't say that in the book. I say that the behavior of overeating and overconsumption is what needs to be stigmatized. Now, one might say it's hard to do, but I would say look at, you know, generally speaking, the more successful public health policies over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. People said the same thing about the, you know, stigmatizing of unsafe sex in the AIDS campaign. They said the same thing about the stigmatizing of smoking in the tobacco campaign. And we know that those campaigns were quite successful in the short run and have had lingering success in the long run. So I tend to think that there is a difference between stigmatizing a person and stigmatizing a behavior. And any parent who's, you know, and I go back to the parent, really, because, you know, it's the parent who's mm-hmm. constantly dealing with that particular issue. Mm-hmm. And we have a generation of parents who are quite good, actually, at saying something like this: Johnny, when you do that, you're going to make yourself sick. Or when you do that, you make, you know, mommy upset. Without specifically singling out Johnny as being bad.
Right.
So I think that is what I'm talking about in terms of stigmatizing gluttony.
But what we have now is a 150-year-long experiment in the United States. Really, this started in the mid-19th century, but really gained tremendous momentum starting about the 1920s or so, in which the idea has been that we tell people that they should consciously restrict their caloric intake for the purposes of regulating their weight in order to remain thin. And the results of this experiment, I think, at this point are really indisputable. They make people fat, basically, by telling people that you should be unhappy with your body, you should be unhappy with your weight, and you should consciously restrict caloric intake for the purposes of regulating your weight. What we do is put people on this weight cycling yo-yo effect, which makes them fatter than they would be otherwise. That's one of the biggest reasons behind the so-called obesity epidemic in the United States. So, in fact, the cure that is pushed essentially by the diet and weight loss industry and those in the obesity research community who are almost wholly funded by that industry
is actually causing
the very problem which people are so upset about.
Paul Campos, you give us lots of reasons to think. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Campos is a professor of law at the University of Colorado and author of the forthcoming book, The Last American Diet. We're asking this hour, how did America become so fat? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking this hour, how did America get so fat so fast? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Greg Kreitzer. He's the author of Fatland, How Americans Became the Fattest People in the World. And joining us now from Los Angeles is Dr. Eloisa Gonzalez. She's the director of the Physical Activity Program at the Los Angeles County Department of Health Services. Welcome, Dr. Gonzalez.
Thank you.
You have been know, of course, far better than we do the statistics on overweight and even obesity among young children. What are you doing in Los Angeles County to combat that?
Well, we have a multitude of efforts that we're really trying to put forth to try and address this epidemic. It's just so alarming that we're seeing so many of our youth at younger and younger ages starting to come down with a lot of the chronic diseases that we didn't typically see until people were in their 40s and their 50s. Now we're seeing them down into teens and 20s. So because youth spend so much of their time in schools, we're really trying to work closely with the schools here in our county to try and get them to improve both the quantity and the quality of physical education that's provided in the schools, as well as the nutritional options that are available to the students, because we find that that's one of the sources for students to basically overeat and eat meals that are really not very nutritious. They're offered oftentimes fast foods and soft drinks that really are not providing them with any substantial sort of nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So we are working on several counts. One of them is, as I mentioned, working with the schools, but we're also trying to work with different partners, such as the American Diabetes Association. Even some private organizations like Nike are willing to step up to the plate at this point and do something about this obesity epidemic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
By that, I mean providing funding, resources, human and financial, both to try and pour into the schools or into other organizations that are trying to address the epidemic.
Of course, California is in straitened circumstances. States all around the country are, and we read that among the first things that are cut out of school budget, usually a physical activity.
Absolutely, and the problem is really magnified here in L.A. County. We have an incredible overcrowding issue, in particular with our schools, and schools are really in a tough position. I really feel for them because they are being pressed very strongly to improve those math and reading scores, and that is coming at the expense of physical education, primarily because in order to increase those math and reading scores, schools are being forced to reduce class sizes, be able to provide more personalized attention with a lower student-teacher ratio. However, the students aren't going to disappear. They have to be put somewhere. There's still the issue of overcrowding. And so what schools, the options that they have is to put them then into a PE class. So now instead of having a PE class with a manageable number of 30 students or so per teacher, you have upwards of 50, sometimes 80, sometimes 90 students per teacher. So that is really a difficult issue for them, the PE teachers, to try and coordinate. How do you coordinate 90 kids at the same time with no aid and the same amount of equipment that you had for 30 kids?
Are your kids, the kids in the Los Angeles County schools or the City of Los Angeles schools, at a marked disadvantage in respect of their diet and their weight issues from, say, the kids at Beverly Hills High School?
Oh, absolutely. There's large discrepancies. There are As in most large urban communities, there are the more affluent areas and then there are the less affluent areas. And in the more affluent areas, there is a lot more resources that get put towards the schools for them to use. So some of them have – we have some spectacular model programs for how PE should be done with students in both middle schools and high schools. However, at the same time, we have some of the most overcrowded and primarily – I don't want to say completely unsupervised, but when you have one teacher for 90 students, the fact is a lot of the students end up being unsupervised and wander off. They're, you know, braiding each other's hair. They're, you know, some of them doing their homework if they're feeling productive, but primarily they're not doing physical education, which is what physical activity is what they're there to do.
Mm-hmm. So you're trying to change practices, but also to change minds and habits with education.
Absolutely, and like I said, it's a huge issue because the students, they're getting a double whammy, let's say, because not only are they not getting the physical activity, but they're being offered a lot of very poor nutrition by the companies that they primarily have to contract with, or I don't want to say have to contract with, but do contract with, fast food companies, soft food companies. But they still do offer the nutritional state-required meals.
Mm-hmm.
However, the students don't eat that. There's always a stigma of, I don't want to be the cafeteria kid. So, you know, they do opt for what, you know, the peer pressure is to go and eat the fast food, which is the less nutritious of the options that they have.
Well, you have an extremely difficult job there. We can only wish you every success. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Gonzalez.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
That was Dr. Eloisa Gonzalez. She's the director of the Physical Activity Program at the Los Angeles County Department of Health Services. We're talking about America the Fat this hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike is calling from Boston. Welcome.
Hi, thanks, Jack. I just wanted to give a different perspective on, I think it's a great topic, but I'm from Canada. I lived there all my life, and I moved down here about 2.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things I noticed when we moved down here, and actually I noticed it before when I used to come down here, and it's just that Canada is by no means much different than the U.S. in terms of its focus on fast food. And there's a McDonald's in every corner and donut shops all over the place. But the size of the portions here, I think, makes a huge difference in terms of the problem that's happening in the U.S. right now. Even at chain stores like McDonald's, Burger King, and those places, just as soon as you cross the border, it seems, from Canada into the U.S., a medium in Canada is a small here, and a small is a medium, and just portions are so incredibly large that I don't know that this was. I think that this is inevitable. It's going to happen down here. I just don't think you see that. I know you don't see it in Canada, and certainly don't see it in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just a fundamental difference in terms of how that bigger is better here, no matter what the cost.
So it's the sort of American factor.
I don't know if it seems to be an American factor. I don't like to say that, but it's just certainly, I've always noticed that if you go to a Burger King
Sure. Here
as opposed to one in Toronto even, which is a big urban center, the size of the portions and the amount of fries you get and the volume of Coke you get is substantially larger here. And you always hear these statistics about, a big value meal at Burger King,
right.
1,400 calories and 80 grams of fat. And it just that seems to be perpetrated the whole way through the fast food industry and other, even in the restaurants, the family restaurants, a 6-egg omelet instead of a 3-egg omelet.
Yes,
it has
yes.
a very detrimental mm-hmm. effect on people's mm-hmm. health.
Greg, I think you're absolutely right. Mike, I think you're absolutely right. Greg Kreitzer, how about that? You get into this issue of portions and so on, but it's interesting to know that Canada, it's not nearly so common, even though they have the same fast food restaurants.
I think there's really a couple things going on there. One is that, in the United States, we generally have had, we have had larger portions in general. If you look at the USDA recommendations for portion sizes from the early 1900s, they're fairly consistent,
mm-hmm.
and they are larger than the French Ministry of Health and their recommendations since 1900. What's different, I think, is that now, in particular, modern capitalism is dedicated more than any one thing to the enlargement of appetite.
Mm-hmm.
And what we know is that fast food makers realize something intuitively that science now is only catching up with, and that is that one's appetite, one's degree of satiety or satisfaction, as they call it, can be enlarged simply by placing larger portion sizes in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what, Taco Bell realized, 25 years ago.
Right. Mike, thank you for your call. Ken is calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hello and welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. We're happy to have you.
I think there's a couple other villains involved with this. One, I think, is the department that puts out the food pyramid, which has changed like three times in 10 years.
Is that the Department of Agriculture?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
The second is I worked with a young person with Prader-Willi, which is a genetic defect, no cessation of appetite, also some internal defects. That person was on a 1,200-calorie-a-day diet,
mm-hmm.
three 45-minute periods of exercise.
Three,
yes. Mm-hmm. If that person would manage to get like three crackers a day,
mm-hmm.
During the week, each day,
mm-hmm.
they would have 3 pounds gain by Saturday. I think there's a basic misunderstanding of the physiology that goes into the transformation of calories into the body mass. The third thing is our exercise programs are slanted towards kind of fight or flight sports active programs.
Yes.
They're not made for continuation
mm-hmm.
and for flexibility and for mm-hmm. increase of burning of fuel in the body.
Yes, and they're all about teams, too. Ken, thank you for this. I wish we could get to all of your points, but let's get to the genetic one and the issue of metabolism, Greg Kreitzer.
I guess I would just take issue with how frequent Prader-Willi syndrome is in the general population.
Mm-hmm.
we know that it's, I believe it's a, It's a change in the allele on the chromosome 20, I think.
But I think he's talking about in general different rates of metabolism in different people.
Sure.
But there's some people they can just eat a little bit and it's going to become fat.
That doesn't. I mean, there's quite a bit of studies on dietary consumption, and what we know is that inevitably when they do a study of people who say, God, I don't eat very much and I still gain weight compared to all my friends, when they actually tally up exactly what they eat, they find that they've usually estimated by only half of what they of their energy intake.
Oh, so it's kind of a false sample.
Yeah, and what you will also see is, I have for example, I struggle with my weight, and I have friends that seem to eat with impunity, but when I really watch them eat, they're not eating half as much as I am. That, generally speaking, is the rule, and that seems to be what studies show. Although he is right. I mean, there are
sure.
extreme examples of people who don't metabolize carbohydrates and fats
sure.
the way the rest of us do.
Let's take a final call from Andrew in Framingham, Mass. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
My question is, what fascinates me, I work at Burger King.
Yeah.
And what's amazing is that I must see hundreds of obese people come through the drive-thru, and they order a Whopper and a king-size fries and the biggest of everything, an apple pie, and then they get a Diet Coke. And why is that? Is it something psychological? What do they think that they would benefit by getting a Diet Coke, with all this fat?
What do you think's going on?
I have no clue. I'm
okay.
fascinated.
All right. Greg Kreitzer?
I don't know. I tend to do the same thing. If I'm getting a relatively high calorie meal, I tend to order a Diet Coke. I mean, I think there's something going on, and maybe with these people he's witnessing, it's their wink and nod that I really deep down know that I'm eating way too much, and this is my attempt at caloric balancing.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no idea, really, where that behavior comes from.
Does that ring true with you, Andrew, that this is a kind of gesture they're making toward normal eating?
I think it probably kind of gives them an excuse to get more fattening foods.
Mm. So what do you think as you see these people coming by?
I'm just fascinated. I personally, a king-size Coke is like 32 ounces, and mm-hmm. I can't really get through a whole medium Coke.
Mm.
So, but I eat a lot all the time, and I never really put on any weight, and I always seem to. Earlier, someone was mentioning that it's what Americans can't seem to find anything else to do. I always seem to wanting to be hungry or wanting to eat something, just because I'm bored.
Mm, yeah, and that'll do it. Well, stay off the burgers and you'll be all right. Thank you, Andrew from Burger King. Greg Kreitzer, we're winding up here, but so much of this is time specific. One of my favorite films is The Misfits. It was a film that Arthur Miller wrote for Marilyn Monroe. It was her last film. And Marilyn Monroe, when I was a kid, was considered the most beautiful woman in America, and beautiful, also sensual. And you look at that movie, and people today would say, "Now there's a fat woman," and yet, my gosh, she defined screen beauty. Something's happened to our ideal too, hasn't it?
Yeah, that change though really begins at the early part of the century. I think Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon is kind of considered by, postmodernists who study the body image issue through history as kind of the turning point of the female ideal. Modernity and modernism has tended to celebrate more slender women.
Vive la France. Thank you, Greg Kreitzer. Greg Kreitzer is the author of Fatland, How Americans Became the Fattest People on Earth. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is